Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Today's obituaries for August 9th. Marie Elizabeth Atkinson, 71, of Odessa, passed away Saturday, August 6th in Odessa. Visitation is scheduled 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Wednesday, August 10th at Sunset Memorial with Jimmy Braswell officiating. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Elizabeth, often called Nan by her loved ones and friends, was born in Cushing, Oklahoma, on March 18, 1951. She married Alan Atkinson in Odessa in 1973. He preceded her in death in 1988. She is survived by daughter Tracy Robinson and her husband Brad Robinson, and their son Brad Dunham and his wife Tiffany Dunham. She is also survived by several grandchildren. Death notices: Elnor Priscilla Hamilton Mayar. Elnor Priscilla Hamilton Mayar, 70, of Odessa, died Wednesday, August 3rd, in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 2 p.m. Tuesday, August 9th, at Salvation Army Church. Burial will follow at a later date. Major Luis Melendez is officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Paul Ormsby, 77, of Midland, died Friday, August 5th, in Midland. Celebration of life is scheduled at 10 a.m. August 13th at First Baptist Church Chapel in Midland. Arrangements are by Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Saturday, August 6th. This article is entitled "Demand Concerns Sent Crude Below $90," by Mella McEwen. Crude prices sank below the $90 barrier this week, pressured by growing concerns about declining demand as global economies weaken, even as oil markets remain tight. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange recorded its biggest weekly loss, nearly 10%, since April, beginning with a $4.73 plunge as trading opened Monday. Declines of $3.76 Wednesday and $2.12 Thursday followed as WTI tumbled below $90. The contract eked out a 47-cent gain Friday to close the week at $89.01. That's well below the $98.62 at last Friday's close. The posted price ended the week at $85.49, according to Plains All American. Natural gas futures on the NYMEX also ended the week with a loss, briefly falling below $8 per MCF with a 57.7 cent drop Tuesday before rebounding with a 56 cent rise Wednesday. Prices dropped 6 cents Friday to end at $8.064 per MCF, down from $8.229 at last Friday's close. Lower oil prices are starting to have an impact on lowering gasoline prices, which helps the economy and everyday people alike, Ben Shepard, president of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, told the Reporter Telegram by email. Friday's unexpectedly strong jobs report, which saw 528,000 jobs added in July, helped crude prices pare some of its losses after a week filled with global recession fears that destroyed the crude demand outlook, Edward Moya, senior market analyst at Oanda, said in his daily newsletter. A robust non-farm payroll is welcome news for the U.S. economy, and that is helping oil pare some of this week's losses, Moya wrote. Europe also posted better-than-expected industrial production data from both Germany and France. Despite all the global economic slowdown worries, the oil market is still tight. He added that some energy traders may be unnerved by a surging dollar and rising risk. The Fed may need to be more aggressive in tightening monetary policy. But with Saudi Arabia and the UAE saving their emergency oil capacity, further downward pressure might be limited, he wrote. With the market remaining tight, and if technical support boosting prices Friday lasts, prices could stabilize above $90 a barrel, Moya wrote. Enverus Intelligence Research, a subsidiary of Enverus, the energy data analytics and SaaS technology company, said in its new macro forecaster report, demand headwinds are building, but oil supplies remain tight with no relief in sight. In its report, the company trimmed its forecast of U.S. oil supply additions to 950,000 barrels a day, with the bulk coming from the Permian Basin. Inflation and rig availability continue to hamper new production, the report said. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Operators Tap Brakes on Drilling. Permian Leads Decline with Drop of 4 Rigs for Week, by Mella McEwen. Oil and gas operators tapped the brakes on drilling activity, sending the rig count lower during the first week of August. Oilfield services firm Baker Hughes said Friday its U.S. rig count, which it has released weekly since the 1940s, fell by 3 to 764. Still, the rig count is 273 rigs, or 56% above the 491 recorded at this time last year. The number of rigs drilling for crude slumped by 7 to 598, the sharpest decline since last September, and the first decline in 10 weeks. The count is 211 rigs higher than the 387 reported last year. The number of rigs seeking natural gas rose by 4 to 161, the highest tally since August 2019. Texas inched up 2 rigs for 373 at work statewide, 144 more than the 229 reported last year. New Mexico sank by 6 rigs to 104. Colorado 2, North Dakota 1, and Wyoming 1 were the other producing states to see higher drilling activity, while Louisiana 3 joined New Mexico in seeing a decline. Activity weakened in the Permian Basin, where the rig count fell by 4 to 347, still 104 more rigs than the 243 at work within the region last year. Declines were led by New Mexico, whose counties showed the biggest drops during the week. Lee County, New Mexico, remains the most active county in the Permian Basin with 55 rigs, down 3 for the week. Eddy County, New Mexico, was second with 46 rigs, also down 3 for the week. Midland County follows with 39 rigs, down 1. Next is Loving County, which added 2 rigs for 29. Reeves County reported 28 rigs for a second week, and Martin County reported 27 rigs, down 1 for the week. Howard County remained at 23 rigs for a second week. Ward County saw 14 rigs at work within county lines, up 2. And Upton County was at 13 rigs for a fourth week. Andrews County reported 10 rigs for the week. Enverus Foundation, part of the energy-focused software-as-a-service firm Enverus, said its U.S. rig count dropped by 10 to 825 as of August 3rd. Its count is down 1% in the last month, but up 47% over the year. Activity reached as high as 842 rigs during the week, 7 rigs higher than the prior week's peak. During July, the count averaged 829 rigs, which is up 15 rigs from the June average. The monthly average has increased every month since August 2020, with 2022 thus far averaging monthly increases of 22 rigs. On a peak-to-peak basis, the Permian added 7 rigs last week. The region's total of 316 is a return to the 2022 high last hit in May. the Anadarko Basin added 3 rigs to reach a weekly peak of 74, while the Williston Basin was up by 1 at 43, and Appalachia was down 1 rig at 56. Weekly peak activity in the DJ Basin and Gulf Coast were flat at 22 and 116.
Obituary for Saturday, August 6th. Charles Dale C.D. Smith. C.D. Smith, 92, of Odessa, passed away Monday, August 1st at Medical Center Hospital. He was born in Goodland, February 11th, 1930, to the late Cecil Dale and Hazel Smith. He married Thelma Ledbetter in Dora, New Mexico, on September 3rd, 1949. C.D. was preceded in death by his parents, his wife, Thelma D. Smith, his son, Douglas Jean Smith, daughter, Susan Elaine Howell, and his 3 brothers and 1 sister, Donnie, Gary, and Kenneth Smith, and his sister, Marilyn. He will be survived by his 2 sons, Roger Smith and wife, Jana, and Eugene Smith and wife, Anita, all of Odessa, 7 grandchildren, and 9 great-grandchildren. Graveside services are scheduled for Monday, August 8th at 2 p.m. at Sunset Memorial Cemetery, officiated by Eugene Smith. Funeral services are under the direction of the Acres West Funeral Chapel. Condolences to the family may be made online at acreswestfuneral.com. Death notices. Gerald Dean Bubba Brown. Gerald Dean Bubba Brown, 69, of Odessa, died Sunday, July 24th. Celebration of life was held Friday, August 5th at Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory. Consuelo Reveles de Reyes. Consuelo Reveles de Reyes, 81, of Andrews, died Tuesday, August 2nd in Seguin. Mass was celebrated August 6th at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church in Andrews. Father Cosmos Archibong was the officiating pastor. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Thelma Ruth Harp Handley. Thelma Ruth Harp Handley, 82, of San Antonio, died Thursday, August 4th. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. August 12th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Lincoln Dale Marchant. Lincoln Dale Marchant, infant of Wink, died Thursday, July 28th in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Georgia Ann Ward. Georgia Ann Ward, 72, of Odessa, died Sunday, July 31st in Odessa. A graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, August 8th, at Sunset Memorial Garden Cemetery. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa.
Hello, friends. This is Julie, reading from the Odessa American, Sunday, August 7th. Remote students get an upgrade. UTPB looks to make remote learning more engaging, by Ruth Campbell. To help faculty create a virtual environment that is more engaging, 2 University of Texas Permian Basin officials have made the IT Telestudent. Telestudent is a skeleton-type robot that lives in the classroom and acts as a student. Senior Instructional Technology Analysis, Curtis Rogers, said it can be put in lectures or small group mode with its 360 camera. Give students a fuller view of the classroom. Many students can connect at once. What they'll be able to do is they can actually look around, either on their computer or through the headset. The classroom is either classmates. The reason it was given a body is to kind of give you a feel that you have someone else in the class with you. Roger said, Brad Shook, Vice President of Information Technology, said what they're trying to do is give the faculty all the tools they need to make their classroom interactive and interesting for students. If I'm sitting down in a class, we can actually lower it down so people at home will have the same perspective as they would if they were in the classroom, Rogers said. The screen will show if someone has a question. It's important because this one telestudent may actually be representing 10 remote students, Rogers said. In this way, he added, teachers don't have to teach differently from remote students. If a student has a question, the professor could answer it through the student was in the classroom. They can hear the lecturer, the instructor all the time, but in order for them to speak, they need to be in small group mode, Rogers said. The remote students can talk to each other, and the in-person students can talk to the telestudent in real time. Shook said the idea came from Clark Moreland, lecturer of English and director of Heimeyer Center of Engaged Teaching. Shook said Moreland had a number of different ideas on how to engage remote students, so he approached the IT team and it went from there. How do you make the students feel like they're not just talking to a webcam on top of a computer? Then for the home students, how do you make them feel like they're part of the class by giving them the freedom to look around at what they want to look at? Especially with the 360 camera, it's a lot more like being in class because sometimes it's just interesting to see who you're in the class with. If somebody's talking other than being stuck on a static camera looking forward, Rogers said. Rogers said there's privacy shield for students who don't want to be seen on the camera. All the technology being used for the telestudent was already in use at UTPB. The main thing about the telestudent is that it brings everything together all at once, and it's kind of why we're really excited about it, because it does involve so many different things that we've had good success with up to this point, Rogers said. In this area, Shook said, there are a lot of oilfield workers that want to go back to school, and a lot of times they can't physically go to class, but this way they can still connect and feel part of the group. During the pandemic, he said, they used Microsoft Teams when they were giving synchronous classes. So if you're watching the chat box, it's really easy to miss the question, so that's the reason we had the big screen. So now, whenever they type it in, it's big. I can see Curtis had a question, and I'm not having to go back to Teams checking, Shook said. Using items that were already around at UTPB are likely around at many school districts. The telestudent was a built-in piece. If they had worked solidly, it would have taken 2 weeks to construct, Rogers said. Shook said that other things they do in his department is making use of free software. Robert says they use open broadcaster software, which a lot of streamers and gamers use. Rogers said the technology can be duplicated pretty handily. Once they go through the fall semester and get feedback from students, Shook said they might change or refine the model. They have also used the technology to help people with social anxiety by making videos of going to a bank and opening an account or making a deposit, for example, so they can familiarize themselves with that. The technology can be shared with other institutions and school districts. Shook said another exciting aspect of the telestudent project is the involvement of student workers who have helped build the frame, put it together, and test it. That's one of the things our department really prides ourselves on, involving a lot of students who we're bringing in and letting them have experience in these projects, work experience that they can put on the resume. One of the things that's really neat about Curtis's department over there at ITS Production is those student workers. By the time they've left, they have all kinds of production on their resume, from 360 video to 2D modeling, Shook said. Shook said they started offering high school students internships last year. Through working with ECISD and their CTE, Career and Technical Education program, the students are actually here for a couple of hours every day, so they get Former Odessan reflects on life after releasing new album by Michael Bauer. Daniel Leon was born in Odessa, where he resided until he was 11. The singer, who recently released his debut album, Soul on Fire, now lives in San Antonio, but he never forgets where he came from. Now age 31, Leon describes his music as being a pop of rhythm and blues soul, with a little bit of funk vibes. Life's been an interesting journey for sure, Leon said. Earlier this year, Leon released Soul on Fire, which has since charted a number 4 on iTunes R&B chart and number 23 on all genres. He said it took him a while to realize his accomplishment. Man, it was honestly, I didn't know what was going to happen. So it was a breath of fresh air, Leon said. It was good to get enough people behind the project, pushing it, liking it, buying it, streaming it. Really, it was awesome. I'm still in awe of the numbers that are happening, which is being number 4 on iTunes. It hasn't hit home that it's all real. I'm still grinding it, making music, and getting ready for tour. It's been crazy. I'm super stoked and super excited. Since his album's release, he has kept the project alive by releasing music videos and performing in different venues around the state. When talking about his time in Odessa, Leon said he went to numerous different schools in town. I went to quite a few schools, Leon said. I went to Milam when I was in the magnet program. My parents had me in a bunch of fine arts classes. My brother and I both were in those classes. I moved around, and then I went to Barbara Jordan Elementary. I went to a bunch of schools. I was on the move a lot. Leon describes his childhood as full of hardships. After going into a homeschool program, Leon dropped out of high school, where he soon started working as a general contractor, working and doing plumbing. I didn't graduate from high school. I ended up dropping out of high school and going to work when I was about 15 or 16. My dad had a heart attack. There were some hardships. I had the means to make decent money making concrete. That's what I did, but growing up, music was a big part of my life. When I was really young, probably like 5 or 6, my brother, Dylan Hogan, who is one of my biggest influences, Leon said, he was like a prodigy when we were kids. He's about 5 years older than me. When he was about 10, he just got really good at a guitar and was starting to play a bunch of songs when I was 7. It was the first time I got on stage with my brother, and we knew right then we were going to do music forever. I was 7 when I got on stage for the first time, and I've been performing on stage since. When I was in Odessa, Leon said, he played drums and soon learned how to play different instruments. I started with drums and then moved over to bass guitar and then later found out that vocals were my niche and something that people were going to remember me for, Leon said. It's been a crazy transition, but it's been great. It wasn't until a couple years back when Leon was signed by Davis Entertainment and his musical career started taking off. He made his debut single, Anchor, which captured an ever-growing audience since its release. That was the first time it took transition into doing music full-time for a living and quit my day job to write music full-time and record music full-time, Leon said. It's been a building process of what my music is today. He says the feedback from his fans has been incredible. I just feel really blessed, Leon said. Fans have been messaging me on Instagram and YouTube. It's been a lot of positive stuff. They've been giving me a lot of positive feedback. I've been feeling really blessed. I'm glad that everybody enjoys my music. I couldn't be more happy. His recent single was Good Day, a song with Leon claims, was recorded in under 7 hours. We recorded that with one of my best friends, Leon said. We called it Good Day because it was the fastest song we've ever recorded on my album. We wrote and mixed and laid it down in 5 hours, which is the fastest I've ever done. We called it Good Day because it was a great day. Leon said he has his own studio at home, which he engineers, mixes, and masters his music, including his album Soul on Fire. I mixed about 80 to 85% of Soul on Fire, Leon said. Music engineering is my thing. I have a home studio, and I work for a commercial studio as well. As far as songwriting goes, Leon describes the process as sometimes stressful and frustrating. It plays on emotions and feelings, Leon said. You're trying to put your heart and soul into it. It's almost like a second wife or girlfriend or a child. It can weigh on your heart and your soul a little bit. But when you finally get a song done, it's one of the most gratifying feelings ever. It's a hot and cold situation. Sometimes it's the best experience and sometimes it's a battle. As Leon looks back on where he's come from, he said the hardships growing up have made him a better person. Man, I'm definitely count my blessings, Leon said. I have some guardian angels. I think I've been all right in life. I think everything I've encountered in life and all the hardships and everything I was supposed to learn was for a purpose. I have a lot of goals and I would like to reach. I would like to give back to children in the communities. If I had to do it all over again, I probably would, because without the hardships, I'd be a different person.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, August 8th. Processed foods and cognitive decline. The story was written by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. I tried to stay current in my crazy job, so I read quite a few nursing and medical journals. Unfortunately, I can't read everything, so I do try to watch topics that work with my job specifics or have a big impact on the patient populations that the hospital serves. One of those areas is dementia. Unfortunately, in the hospital, we see quite a bit of dementia, to the point that it sometimes seems like most people over the age of 65 have some level of dementia. That is not true, of course. It is the opposite. Most people over 65 are healthy, active, and mentally sound, which, of course, is why we don't see them in the hospital. One of the articles I read recently on dementia was based on a presentation at the 2022 Alzheimer's Association International Conference, and it showed a significant link between cognitive decline and ultra-processed foods. Ultra-processed foods, for the purposes of this study, were defined as food that contained artificial flavorings, artificial colorings, emulsifiers, and other cosmetic additives. In other words, most of the things that are prepackaged, processed, and ready-to-eat foods. The things that make our busy multitasking days easier. We've known for years that processed foods increase the risk of obesity, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and cancer. So, I am not completely surprised that those foods are not good for our brains either. But what really amazed and quite frankly scared me about this study is how little of those foods it takes to cause a big decline in cognitive function. The study followed 10,000 people in Brazil for 10 years. Half of the participants were women, half were white, half were college-educated. The average age for people in the study was 51. Over the years, these subjects were given cognitive testing, which included immediate and delayed word recall, word recognition, and verbal fluency, and were asked about their diets. They found that people who had more than 20% of their calories come from ultra-processed foods showed a 28% faster rate of cognitive decline than those that ate fewer processed foods. 20% is not a lot of calories, unfortunately. For an average adult, nutritionists recommend about 2,000 calories daily to maintain a healthy weight. 20% of 2,000 calories is only 400 calories. I looked at a couple of well-known fast food restaurant websites, and the lowest calorie counts I could find were for the kids' meals, and even there, the lowest calorie count I could find was 390 calories, while most of us eat on those menus are double or even triple that calorie count. The average American gets nearly 57% of their calories from ultra-processed foods. In children and teens, that percentage is closer to 70%. In the study, the biggest consumers of ultra-processed foods were young, under age 40, white women with higher educations who had never smoked and used little to no alcohol. Everything but the age part is me. That was eye-opening, to say the least. The study is just one more piece of evidence that what you put into your mouth matters. Food can be a medicine that heals, and it also could be a poison that slowly kills. Good diet choices are hard. It takes more time and effort to make a meal from scratch than go by a drive-through. It's easier to buy lunch or grab something out of a vending machine than to pack a lunch. Unfortunately, those easy choices are the ones that generally lean heavily on the food as a poison side of the equation. I will be honest, this is absolutely a case of the pot calling the kettle black. I eat way, way too much processed foods. But I am trying to be better. This study makes me want to try even harder. I want to see my grandkids grow up and know who they are and when they do it. I am hoping you feel the same about your diet after reading this. If you need help figuring out the best healthy choices for food and how to cook in a healthier way, a consult with a registered dietitian is a great place to start. Your primary healthcare provider can help you get a referral to see a dietitian. Just ask.
Biophosphonate drugs, osteoporosis. Dear Dr. Roach, you recently wrote on the concerns of biophosphonate drugs like alendronate, Fosamax, and people with osteoporosis. These drugs, especially intravenous zoledronic acid and the antibody to rank ligand, denosumab, have been game changers in patients with breast and other cancers that spread to the bone. They have dramatically reduced the incidence of dangerously high calcium in people with cancer and have substantially reduced bone fractures due to cancer as well as bone pain. There is a considerable body of literature supporting their use as additional therapy to reduce reoccurrence and even mortality in selected patients with early stages of breast cancer. When we first started using them at the University of Michigan Rogel Cancer Center, we observed osteonecrosis of the jaw in about 10% of treated patients. We quickly realized we could reduce the risk by using them less frequently, every 3 months, rather than every month like we used to, and by having our patients see dentists to ensure hygiene before we start. With these considerations, the incidence of osteonecrosis of the jaw with biophosphonates or denosumab have dropped to less than 1%. These medicines are very important for patients with cancers that have spread to the bone, and we don't want people afraid of these very effective agents that are safe when used correctly. DF. Answer. I appreciate the information from Dr. Daniel F. Hayes and am happy to share with my readers.
This is the Dear Abby column. Teenagers' breakup puts parents in awkward spot. Dear Abby, a couple of weeks ago, my 17-year-old daughter broke up with Matt, her boyfriend of a year and 7 months. My husband and I are sad because Matt had become a part of our family. We included him in vacations and holidays with us. We also became friends with his parents and shared a couple of holidays with them. I have not communicated with them since the breakup, and I feel horrible. I'm not sure what's proper etiquette in this situation. Should I reach out to Matt's mom or just leave it alone? I don't have hard feelings towards them. But then again, my daughter broke up with Matt and not vice versa. Let me know what you think. Signed, Broken Up Over Breakup. Dear Broken Up, young love doesn't always last forever, which can be a good thing. I see no harm in waiting a few more weeks until things cool down and then reaching out to Matt's mother. Tell her you are sorry about the breakup and hope it doesn't spell the end of your relationship with her, which you have very much enjoyed. Her response will tell you if she feels the same. Dear Abby, we are a couple married for 46 years. Of course, one of us will be passing on in the future. If my husband goes first, I'm unsure about how to handle any services for him. He has narcissistic personality disorder, and over the course of our marriage, he has made my life a living hell. I have grown to despise him. I need to be respectful of his children and friends. Only a few close women friends know the situation. I want to have a proper remembrance for them that won't involve too much of my presence. He will be cremated per his request. Can you suggest how I should handle this? Signed, Careful in California. Dear Careful, discuss this with the person who will officiate at the memorial service when the time comes. Be as active a participant as you would like. Leaving the eulogizing to the people who loved him, his friends and children, is your privilege. Dear Abby, my daughter is 38 and still can't forgive me for being an alcoholic when she was young. Will I never be forgiven? I have had my drinking under control for 6 years now. What else can I do? I don't want to leave this world and not be good with her. It's killing me. I need my baby girl back. Signed, Sober Mom in Kentucky. Dear Mom, You didn't mention what personality changes you experienced when your daughter was young. Whether you were abusive or emotionally absent, the truth is she lost her mother during that period. You may need your baby girl back, but that baby is long gone. If you are not in AA, you should definitely attend some meetings to see how other parents cope with their loss. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.